I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 11th of February. This hour of the program, the contributing editor at The Atlantic and National Journal, who is the author of a lot of things, but what caught our attention recently is Liberal is Good, published in the current Atlantic, subtitled The Label, sought after during the New Deal days, has long since become an epithet. But the nationwide drop in violent crime and the collapse of hawkish foreign policy create an opening to reclaim it. Peter is also Associate Professor of Journalism and Political Science at the City University of New York, Senior Fellow at the New America Foundation, and author of The Good Fight, Why Liberals and Only Liberals Can Win the War on Terror and Make America Great Again. He references, some of you may have seen this, in the middle of his Super Bowl interview, Bill O'Reilly picking up the dreaded L word and using it in the direction of the president. Are you the most liberal president in U.S. history? O'Reilly asked Obama. Obama said, in a lot of ways, Richard Nixon was more liberal than I was. I tend not to think about these things in terms of liberal and Democrat or liberal and conservative. We're going to be welcoming phone calls from Peter. When you hear that term liberal, what comes to your mind? Is it a negative? Is it a positive? Who do you consider liberal presidents? Are there significant differences between liberals and progressives? And we'll look at the history of the word as well with Peter. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Hello, Peter. Thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Why do you think the president answered Bill O'Reilly in that way? He was backing away from liberal as quickly as he could, wasn't he?
Well, this has been the pattern amongst national Democratic politicians going back several decades now, to believe that the ideal liberal, that the term liberal is kind of inevitably poisoned by negative stereotypes about lack of law and order, about lack of moral standards, about weakness, about big government. And so what you've tended to find, and this really goes back even to the 1980s, is that Democratic politicians will either choose the word progressive instead, or they will avoid any labels whatsoever, and they'll simply try to talk about the policies they support.
And do you think there's a significant difference between the progressive label and the liberal label as you apply those to politicians today?
There's not necessarily, I think, a significant policy difference. The two terms do have different intellectual traditions. The progressive term progressive really starts earlier, in the early part of the 20th century, especially coming out of places like Wisconsin. And I think basically part of what liberal kind of as an American term was really championed by, as a pro-welfare state term, was championed by Franklin Roosevelt. And if you think about the two terms, they do have very different valences. Of course, the idea of progressive is a more natural alternative to conservative, right? Conservative means you want to conserve what already exists. Progressive means you want to change things to make them better. Progressive suggests a kind of historical optimism, an idea that things will naturally get better, which was typical of the early 20th century, less the case, I would say, by the 1930s and 40s. The liberal, interestingly, and one of the reasons it's been so contested, it focuses on the idea of liberty, the idea of freedom, right, which is what conservatives also focus on. The important idea about the way Franklin Roosevelt used the term liberal was to say, it's not just that when government gets bigger, you inevitably become less free, because if government is providing you the kinds of public goods that you need, a good education, a clean environment, safe streets, social insurance, so you don't, so you're not old, you're not poor when you're old, all those kind of things, that government can actually enhance your freedom to be the kind of person you want to be.
You know, when I think of politicians who embody the word liberal, there's one who comes to mind immediately, and it's hard to come up with a really long list. But the gentleman who comes to my mind is, Hubert Humphrey.
Well, interestingly, I think Humphrey did very well embody what liberalism meant in the first couple of decades after World War II, which is to say Humphrey was a very unapologetic supporter of labor unions,
mm-hmm.
a very unapologetic supporter of a large government that provided a large, strong welfare state and wasn't afraid to tax people to do it, probably more unapologetically in that regard than the more Democrats of more recent times on a question, for instance, like national health care, a single-payer health care. And, of course, Humphrey made his name also by supporting civil rights, which was very central, the idea that government could require private businesses not to discriminate, which many, many conservatives opposed at that time. But I think what made Humphrey different than the liberals who emerged in the post-Vietnam era was that Humphrey was also a very muscular anti-communist, someone who believed in the idea of American military power to fight the Cold War. And if you look at Humphrey's kind of tragic break with his own fellow liberals that occurs in the late 1960s around Vietnam, it's because he's still espousing a liberalism that's focused on military intervention to fight communism when a lot of younger liberals are deciding that liberalism shouldn't mean that anymore.
Oh, that's interesting. Do you think that a large part of liberal becoming a nasty word had to do with the 1960s and particularly a changing morality with hippies and the way they were portrayed in Free Love Summers and just a breakdown of a moral code that had been with us for a long period of time? Was that what turned everybody or was it something more than that?
I think that was a lot of it. I think that in the 60s and then particularly in the 1970s, in a time when a lot of Americans felt that culture was spinning out of control and becoming very threatening, that you had a young generation of younger people who were rejecting a lot of the traditional norms, especially having to do with sexuality, that people kind of felt like anchored American society. And then you had a very significant rise in crime and a sense of real fear. And liberals, I think, were perceived as either egging on these forces of cultural chaos or at least not being willing to stand up to them. And if you look at the appeal of someone like Richard Nixon, for instance, as Richard Nixon ran his campaigns in 68 and 72, a lot of it was him speaking as the guy who would stand up to these forces of lawlessness and chaos. And I think liberalism became tarred, fairly or unfairly, with those threatening forces.
Mm-hmm. And when you write in the article, by the 1960s and over the next two decades, being a liberal came to mean letting criminals terrorize America's cities. How did conservatives label liberals in that regard, and what were they specifically talking about? Who were these criminals terrorizing the cities that were the fault of liberals?
Well, remember, liberalism was, in the 1960s especially, focused a lot on rights, the rights of various different groups. And so the focus on rights meant that liberals believed that there needs to be limitations on the power of police. There needs to be rights of people accused of crime, especially, of course, because those people very often were disproportionately minorities that had historically been discriminated against legally in the United States. And I think it was that perspective coming at a time when a lot of people, especially a lot of white people, felt threatened by crime and in ways that often had a very racial tone to them, led to the conservative backlash that was so important for politicians like Nixon and Reagan. You could even see it in the culture of the time, you know, the kind of Clint Eastwood movies of the time, the sense that that the powers, that the liberal politicians or liberal judges aren't willing to stand up to the frightening forces that are menacing you in the street.
Mm. And the response to that by conservatives, or I assume by conservatives, was very dramatic, so that we got three strikes, you're out. We have our prisons very, very crowded with nonviolent offenses in many cases. It was a dramatic response to a perceived threat, wasn't it?
Right. I mean, it's almost a little bit hard to remember now because we're in a different moment. But in the 1988 presidential campaign, crime and the death penalty was perhaps the single biggest issue. And there was an absolute kind of manic push by Republicans, but also by a lot of Democrats who were very afraid of being considered soft on crime, to dramatically increase the amount of time that people were incarcerated, to expand the use of the death penalty. And it's only now, I think, several decades later, largely because crime has gone down, that that the Obama administration, and to their credit, some Republicans, even Republicans like Rand Paul, for instance, are beginning to say that the giving up on the idea of rehabilitation and locking up so many, you know, even nonviolent offenders is, first of all, economically puts a huge burden on states, and secondly, isn't actually a wise policy in terms of giving people a chance to make something of their lives.
Mm-hmm. Were you shocked by what the president said on TV when he talked about Richard Nixon and this, "I tend not to think about these things in terms of liberal and Democrat or liberal and conservative"? I mean, I think that's probably true about the president. I don't think he does think about things in those terms.
Well, to some degree, what Obama said was correct, which is to say, when it came to the questions about the size of government and regulation of the environment, for instance, Nixon was in some ways more liberal than Obama, and it is a sign of how dramatically the Republican Party began to change under Ronald Reagan and then continue to change in more recent decades, that Republicans were quite often quite at the forefront of expansions of the welfare and the regulatory state into the 1970s. I think that, you know, whether Obama really thinks in terms of liberal or not, you know, on the one hand, I suppose Obama thinks of himself as a pragmatist, a problem solver, but I tend to think that nobody can entirely get away from ideology, because ideology really has to do with a set of values that you have, and politics is not math. You have to come to it with a certain sense of what the values that you believe are most important for your society to embody. And so I think Obama does have a set of values. And whether he wants to use the word liberal or progressive, I think there is an emphasis on the ability of government to move us closer to equality of opportunity and to reduce suffering that is caused by, you know, forces outside of people's control, that I think does make him different than the conservatives that he often faces in the Republican Party.
You see in your article the percentage of Americans calling themselves liberal has risen in recent years, although it still trails conservative self-identification. Do you know what the figures are in that regard and what people are, how they're responding when they say, yes, I'm a liberal, or yes, I'm a conservative in 2014, Peter?
Well, the right now, a conservative leads liberal by about 15 points, which is a little bit lower than it was. The most dramatic impact has been actually in people has been a rise of people who call themselves neither liberal nor conservative. But there has been a slight increase in liberal, and I think that's probably stronger amongst younger people. It's hard to know, though, what people often mean by these terms, because one of the puzzles is that although for a long time now Americans have preferred the term conservative, that when you actually ask Americans a whole series of practical policy questions, you tend to find that more of them end up on the liberal side. Questions like, you know, would you pay more in taxes to have, you know, more Social Security, or more money for education, or these kind of things. And so people have speculated about what's really going on here. One theory is that conservative has a positive image that may be a holdover from things that are not part of politics. The conservative suggests traditional, it suggests prudent, things that people like to think about themselves, even if they're also telling pollsters that, yeah, sure, that they would rather have the government tax the rich a little more to pay for more education or more environmental spending and this kind of thing. But I also suggest in my article that one of the things that may be going on is simply that for several decades now, self-described conservatives have been going around saying conservative is a great term, something you should be identified with. You can barely turn on Fox or listen to a Republican politician without hearing the virtues of being a conservative. Whereas liberals have, politicians and liberal commentators have basically run away from the word for several decades now. So nobody has actually been defending it as a term of any value, which I think may be part of the reason that the American public has gotten the idea that, well, there must be something wrong with this term.
Peter Beinart is our guest this hour, contributing editor at The Atlantic and National Journal, associate professor of journalism and poli-sci at City University of New York, author of an article in The Atlantic, current issue, Liberal is Good. He's also author of The Good Fight, Why Liberals and Only Liberals Can Win the War on Terror and Make America Great Again. We interviewed him on that a few years ago. It was published in 2006. That was a while ago, I guess, now. Time, it does go by. So we have lines open right now. Let's take it in a number of directions. How do you identify yourself? Are you a proud liberal? Are you a proud conservative? What do those terms mean to you in 2014? What did they mean to this country in 1960? Is it time for liberals or progressives to reclaim a label that has been debased by conservatives in this country? Are there a set of liberal beliefs that you hold dear and near? Are there conservative beliefs that you hold that way? It's interesting that in certain areas, and our guest makes reference to this, when you look at the issue of same-sex marriage or legally smoking pot, that those, I guess, are, I don't know if they're liberal or conservative issues or libertarian issues in a way, but isn't it interesting that we've moved into a time where those probably traditional liberal ideas are becoming much, much, much more accepted in America. All right, to your phone calls in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to phone calls and start them with Ralph in Little Suamico. Hi, Ralph.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
I don't think this was brought up. I didn't hear all the comments, but my problem is that I find myself to be fiscally conservative, but socially liberal. And so I don't fit in either one of those categories. And so sometimes when the Republicans rant about clamping down on personal freedoms, it turns me off. But then when the liberals say, well, we've got to spend a lot more money on these programs, we don't really care about the debt. We just got to pump more money into government programs, that upsets me too. So I don't have a home other than being a libertarian, which, of course, nobody ever gets elected when they're libertarian. So I'm kind of out there all by myself.
How do you vote? How do you vote, Ralph? Do you vote Republican or Democratic or both?
I vote whoever fits my description better.
Uh-huh.
Like, I would vote for Feingold because I feel he is socially liberal.
Mm-hmm.
But then, again, he may vote for something that just busts the budget, and then I won't vote for him the next time. So
okay.
It's kind of a problem because I'm looking for that guy that is a little more cautious with spending money and still wants to maintain personal freedoms.
So what is Ralph, Peter?
Well, I think libertarian is right. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's important to remember that the two sets of identities that have emerged in the two political parties, or in these what we call liberal and conservative, which is kind of, you know, on the liberal side, it's a more dovish view on foreign policy. It's a more more open, you know, more kind of a view of less government regulation of sexual and moral issues, but more government regulation of the economy, that there's not any necessary logical consistency to those things. And it may be just as logically consistent to say, as the caller does, that you want the government out of your wallet and out of your bedroom, right, as libertarians would suggest. And libertarians have often felt ill at ease in both parties, ill at ease amongst conventional liberals on economic issues, ill at ease amongst conventional conservatives on cultural issues like abortion or gay rights. I think one of the most interesting candidates in the 2016 election may be Rand Paul, because although Rand Paul is trying to fit into a Republican primary and appeal to conservatives, he really does come out of a libertarian tradition where he is somewhat skeptical of more than other Republicans of government intervention in the cultural sphere. He has talked, for instance, about some of the criminal justice policies that most conservatives have tended to embrace. He's a little bit more open to things like legalization of marijuana. And so I think he might be the kind of candidate who your caller might find intriguing.
And Ralph also fits what you describe in your article. He's not atypical. It's remarkably consistent. You say Americans are in telling researchers that they prefer liberal policies, but they prefer the term conservative. What's that? What does that mean?
Well, you know, there are various explanations for why that may be. Again, one of them may be that conservative has certain positive valence that people that doesn't necessarily have to do with policy views. Just it suggests prudent and traditional in a way people like, even if they actually, you know, want the government to spend more money on Social Security or education. Another, as I suggested earlier, may be that it's just that conservative people who call themselves conservatives have really embraced and championed the term, and people who get called liberals have run away from it. So that has sent the message to the public that liberal is a negative term and something you don't want to be associated with. And so what interested me in the article was the question of whether it was possible to take liberal from an epithet and make it positive. And the analogy I used was to a term like queer, which was originally an anti-gay epithet, but gays and lesbians decided to basically take that term and start using it proudly to describe themselves, saying we don't have anything to be embarrassed about. And actually now, in many places, queer is actually mostly used as a term, of kind of pride in being LGBT.
Hmm. Thanks, Ralph, for the call. Al in Madison, hello.
Yes, well, when I think about the government, we don't want to get into that, but the term liberal and conservative, there's far right and far left. And I think that, for instance, the Republican Party, with the conservative thing, is trying to, stay away from that term, too, because of the Tea Party. So I think it's both in both directions, both with conservative and liberal.
Oh, that's an interesting thought. Do you think that's true, Peter?
Well, the Republican Party definitely has, I think, suffered a bit. You've seen it in some of the senatorial races in 2012 and 2010 with candidates who are considered to be a bit too extreme. You know, one of the ironies of the whole idea of being a conservative is that conservatives are supposed to be against change. Right? You're supposed to want to conserve things. But the dilemma that contemporary American conservatives find themselves in is that they are sitting in 2014 with a government that they believe has grown far too big and a welfare state that they don't really basically agree with. So the question is, in order to get back to the principles you want, which is an America that has a much smaller government, you actually have to support really dramatic change. Right? To conserve would be to conserve what we already have, which is a government that is too big by conservative standards. And so that's why sometimes conservatives can come off to Americans as kind of radical, because they want to make all these dramatic changes. They want to get back to the America they imagined maybe, in the 19th century when the federal government was much weaker. But that doesn't seem to a lot of people like conserving what we have. It seems like radical change, which sometimes can be frightening.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Al. Scott in La Crosse. Hello, Scott.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
As somebody who is more or less remembers the 60s, I would like to cite the part of what became went into the making of liberal as a dirty word was not just the right, but it was also the left.
And
the real hardcore anti-war activists of the 60s and early 70s, the last thing you wanted to say about anybody was that they were a liberal. and the liberals were kind of pigeonholed in the center. And I think the perfect example of this is the folk singer-songwriter Phil Oakes, just scathing ballad, "Love me, love me, love me, I'm a liberal."
Right. I think what the call is saying is exactly right, and it's a really important point, which is to say, one of the things that we forget about liberal now, because liberal is considered to be the left-wing position, is that to be a liberalism has always been a reformist, not a revolutionary creed. Liberals have always been about gradual change within the system. They've wanted more change than conservatives have, but liberals have never been about tearing down the basic edifice of society, at least not in the United States, and creating something new. And so that's why genuine revolutionaries, people who really wanted to create an entirely different political system, have often seen liberals as their greatest enemies, because liberals are the ones who they see as kind of tinkering around the edges and prettying things up a little bit and allowing fundamentally unjust institutions to continue. And that's exactly what happened in both the 1930s, when there were people who, to Franklin Roosevelt's left, who wanted communists and socialists who wanted a much more fundamental transformation, who saw that what Roosevelt was doing with the New Deal was basically making capitalism tolerable when they wanted to get rid of capitalism. And it was what happened in the 1960s when people on the left wanted to fundamentally change the nature of American society and saw that liberals were making American capitalism and American democracy just tolerable enough for people to stick with. I think what conservatives said about liberals wasn't necessarily that liberals were the ones preaching revolution, but from the conservative point of view, the liberals weren't strong enough in resisting those frightening, chaotic revolutionary forces. And I think, as the caller exactly said, in some ways what happened to liberals was they got trapped in this position in between.
Thank you, Scott, as always, for your call. What are the origins of the term? Does it go way back, centuries ago, where somebody brought up the term liberal and it has stuck ever since? Or is it a creation of the New Deal?
No, the term goes back much further. I mean, the term basically has to do with, the term liberty is part of liberal, and liberty, which is really a synonym for freedom. You know, those two terms basically mean the same thing. They just have different linguistic roots. Really has to do with the idea that you should be free from government constraint, and the government should not tell you what to do as long as you're not hurting anyone else. And this idea was particularly strongly emerged on the question of freedom of religion, right? The idea that government, it wasn't government's role to tell you what religion to practice, and you couldn't tell anyone else. And then from that, a whole notion of rights that you had that the government shouldn't infringe upon emerged. That was the traditional idea. The real change and the real innovation, which starts in the early 20th century in the United States and Europe, is the idea that it's not only government that can infringe upon your liberty, but that actually other forces, businesses, social institutions, patterns of discrimination, even oppression within the family, all of those can also limit your ability to, you know, make of yourself what you want. And therefore, you might actually need the government to come in and be stronger in order to make, to give you the freedom to do what you want to do, which is to say, to use a really dramatic example, that if the government doesn't make sure that you are literate, right, if the government doesn't provide you an education, you're not really that free. Yeah, the government may not be telling you what to do, but if you don't have the ability to read and write, you're not genuinely a free person. If you don't have safe streets and a safe environment. And so this is the more modern idea of liberalism that really emerged with Franklin Roosevelt, and I think I would associate with the people in the Democratic Party who consider themselves liberals today.
Our number is 800-486-8655. Some lines are open right now if you'd like to join this conversation, and we'd love to hear from you. Our guest is Peter Beinart. He's a contributing editor at The Atlantic and the National Journal, and he has written a piece, Liberal is Good, which appears in The Atlantic. It's on our Facebook page in case you've missed it. He also wrote a book. We interviewed him about this book some time ago, a few years ago, although it seems like yesterday because life goes so fast. And that book looked at The Good Fight and was titled The Good Fight, Why Liberals and Only Liberals Can Win the War on Terror and Make America Great Again. 800-486-8655. Let's go to email message here, Peter. Increasingly, this person writes, I personally favor the term progressive because as a word, it reflects my own perspective on our society and my wishes for it, a society and polity that continues to make progress toward a developing future.
Right. What's interesting about progressive is that progressive really, in the United States, kind of predates the use of the term liberal in the way Franklin Roosevelt used it. And then, starting in the 1990s, kind of after liberal had been tarred, progressive came back. And as I suggested earlier, there is a more natural contrast between the idea of progressive and conservative. What's interesting about progressive is it, as opposed to liberal, is it doesn't emphasize this question of the centrality of preserving liberty or preserving freedom, which is one difference. And the other is this idea of historical optimism, which was really a feature of the early 20th century when reformers had tremendous optimism about the ability to make a society better and better. What happened by after World War II and the Depression and the crimes of Stalin and Hitler and the atomic bomb is that people became a lot more chastened in their and a lot less certain that history always moved forward, that the history was always a story of progress. And so in some ways, to confidently call yourself a progressive, to be sure that basically history was going to always make things better, it was much harder to make that argument in the 1940s after all the horrors that had occurred over the last two decades. And I think that's part of the reason that progressives fell out of favor a little bit.
Mm-hmm. And I didn't see the first part. Paul, this is part of the same email here. This is interesting as well. I'm not the only person who distinguishes between small C conservative and big C conservative. He says small C conservatives interested in preserving many of our institutions and traditions, facing change and expense, not with fear, but with prudence and due diligence. Big C conservatives, namely as a part of affiliation titles, seemingly not interested in really conserving any of those. Goodbye to public education, goodbye to pensions and benefits, to civil discourse and compromise, etc. Is that too harsh?
Well, I think he's getting at something which is important, which is this dilemma for conservatives of what it is you want to conserve, right? This is the problem, as I mentioned earlier, for conservatives is that there are things that they were against that were innovations, like a larger government, like for instance the right to abortion, or Social Security and Medicare, which have now become kind of deeply part of our society. So the question for someone, for a conservative, is do you conserve those things because they've been around for a long time? And conservatives, going back to Edmund Burke, have always had a lot of reverence for what is, for the kind of social, the cultural norms that have emerged over time. Or do you say, no, we need to change these things in order to get back to an earlier kind of America that we had? And this is a dilemma you find oftentimes amongst contemporary conservatives. There's another challenge for American conservatives, which is that America was born in the capitalist age. This is what makes American conservatism different than European conservatism. So when Americans talk about what they want to conserve, conservatives often have this kind of idea of what America was like in the 19th century when the government was really small and the free market was less fettered. But capitalism is a force for tremendous change. So if you want to conserve traditional morality, for instance, allowing an unregulated market in which basically, whatever sells goes, is not necessarily a very good way of preserving traditional morality, right? I mean, conservatives are very upset at what's happened to the culture since the 1960s, but a lot of the reason for some of the things they don't like in the culture, the glorification of sex, for instance, is capitalism at work. There's a reason
that's
that people,
true.
Right?
Right.
It's not because of fiendish liberals and government bureaucrats. Look at Fox itself, right? Fox is the representation of conservative ideas, Fox News Channel. But if you look at Fox television station, they've got many of the most sexualized programs on TV because
right.
that's what people want to watch. And that's, I think, a kind of dilemma for conservatives about the whole idea of capitalism, which they believe is so liberating and so economically productive, but culturally can be very corrosive.
Mohammed is next in Milwaukee. Hi, Mohammed.
Hello, how are you?
All right, how are you?
Okay. I have a comment and a question. My comment is that we are at a stage where liberalism and conservatism, they are offered to themselves, and we need a new approach, a new vision. And thus we need a president with a group of people around him or around her to really see a different vision, a different road to the United States, where we really are beloved outside, have friends, not have enemies, and inside we have enough economical resources to everybody to enjoy themselves. And it is not, maybe the liberalism and conservatism, they are really done. They used up their capital. We need a new approach. So the new approach is a new vision. The difference between, for example, Obama and FDR, Obama of FDR, when he came to power, he had lots of people around him to really consult and meet with them and discuss issues and how to approach a change. Obama, he came with the speeches, the good rhetoric, the good personality. He had nobody around him to really to move for a change, to change the country to a better. And we always could do that. And my question is that, don't you see that this military budget we have, it is not needed at this time, where we could take, scale down the military budget and really give it a tax break to the good corporation, to the public, to the working people, to the farmers, where we could produce more and we could have more, internal economical work to really lift up the people and really give them good income by having programs. And for the foreign policy, if we are to make friends around the world, we are not going to make it through wars. We're going to make it through good foreign aid and good economical aid and good programs, and not to involve ourselves with wars or aggressions or control. How can we try to control the world when we hardly can control ourselves?
Interesting thoughts. Peter?
Well, I do think that probably America is moving into an era in which it's going to be more reluctant to use military force. We've had two very costly wars in Iraq and Afghanistan that have cost that, and I think Americans, there's very little eagerness amongst the American people and even amongst most American foreign policy elites to do anything like that again. And we're also in an era of a kind of tight budgetary environment where just the sheer cost of that would be much more limited. I think that I think probably the defense budget is already started to go down and will continue to go down somewhat. I think the big question for American military policy probably in the coming years and decades will be, what kind of military presence does the United States feel it needs in the Pacific vis-a-vis Asia? You know, America has historically used its navy to maintain its ability to have free commerce across the seas. And that has been a historically very kind of core element of American national security and our national interest. And I think that they're figuring out what that means today in an environment where China is asserting more and more of its right to control the waters around East Asia, I think will be a defining element of how America thinks about how it spends its money on defense.
Thank you, Mohammed, so much for your call. And we'll take more of them momentarily. Peter Beinart is our guest, contributing editor, Atlantic and National Journal, and senior fellow at the New America Foundation. We're responding to his thoughts in a piece that was just in the Atlantic, and it's titled Liberal is Good. And we're looking at all these labels that we toss around and how they have been used, what they mean now, how they've been used negatively by some parties to describe another party, and used the negative definition that we get is so pervasive that it becomes a nasty word, which may have been the case with liberal. Tomorrow during this time period, tomorrow is Abraham Lincoln's 205th birthday. I've always had a little party for him at my house, even if I'm the only one who attends the party. And tomorrow, because he was a significant guy, if you listen to my show, you know I feel that way about Abraham Lincoln. So we always mark his birthday, and we're going to talk to the author of really a fascinating book. I've been reading it, Lincoln's Boys, John Hay, John Nicolay, and the War for Lincoln's Image. They, of course, were Lincoln's presidential secretaries and were with him. They were with him, very close confidants, in the darkest and loneliest days of the war. And what they wrote about the administration after Lincoln's assassination in many ways defines our image of Abraham Lincoln. So the author of that book is with us tomorrow, and that is during this time period. More phone calls momentarily. Thanks, Mohammed, for yours. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go back to phone calls. Jake in Milwaukee is next. Hi, Jake.
Yeah, it's hard to define liberal without how it's been defined for people who are liberals for them by conservatives for the past, 40, 50 years. I think what happened is when the Dixiecrats went over to the Republican Party, and at the same time you have white flight into the suburbs and now the exurbs, what you're finding is a culmination of basically a smaller but very powerful racial, I don't say backlash, that is culminating in its power now, because the thing is, it is reflected by policy. I mean, I hate to say it, growing up I thought, Milwaukee was really nice in the north, where north you're not the south. But right now, we're one of the most segregated cities racially in the country. And the policy of the governor and the Republicans reflect that. So I just think it's just one of the issues for someone's going to call us from liberal is that it's been too long where we let ourselves be labeled the way we are. I mean, that's about it.
So. All right. Thanks, Jake. Peter.
I agree. I mean, that was part of the point of my article, that I think that instead of Obama running away from the term, I think that there may be an opportunity now for liberals to try to reclaim it and invest it with, you know, with the positive meaning that it had for Franklin Roosevelt, the idea that a government that provides the public goods, the kind of basic social insurance, the kind of economic security, that allows people to have the opportunity to make, you know, to really do what I think we would all hope that freedom does allow us, which is to basically give us, you know, allow ourselves to ride, to go as far as our own natural talents and hard work can take us. And which means, you know, that you have some guarantee of health care, for instance. And the challenge has been that I think, as the caller rightly points out, for many decades, liberal has taken on a kind of a, there's been a racial coloration, as there so often is in American politics, in which the idea of government support and government help, I think, got identified with government support and government help to people who were not like me, whether they were African Americans or now increasingly immigrants. And so I think one of the challenges always for liberals is to create enough of a sense of solidarity among people across racial and ethnic lines that people are willing to support government help for people who are not necessarily like them. And that has been a great, tremendous challenge in the United States and even indeed around the world. You tend to find that the countries that have the largest welfare states, that provide the greatest degree of economic security, for instance, the state countries of Northern Europe, tend to have been the most ethnically and racially homogenous.
Yes.
And that racial and cultural and religious and ethnic diversity puts a great strain on the social solidarity that is necessary to be willing to say, okay, I'm going to pay a little more of my taxes to go for someone else's kids in public school or to go to someone else's health care or that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Jake. John in Appleton. Hi.
Yes, I think as the hour goes on, you kind of throw up your arms and say, I mean, these things mean so many different things that, you know, they're kind of useless as terms. I'll add two more dimensions. One is economic class. Conservatives tend to be those people who've done fairly well by the current system, so I'd rather keep the current system like it is. And liberals have less to lose, so they're more open to change. Another dimension would be, I guess mentioned earlier, Edmund Burke versus John Locke. Do you trust the masses to make decisions, or do you think that it should be more of an elite to keep the masses under control? So be interested in your reaction.
Thanks, John.
Yeah, I think there's a lot there. I think historically there has been a conservative distrust of the masses. You see it in some of the basic building blocks of our political system, in which for instance, senators were not directly elected by the people. There was a strong desire to create some distance from the people, and there were lots of restrictions on the ability of various groups to vote at the beginning. And you still see some of that residue sometimes with conservatives, for instance, on the question of how easy it is to vote. I think overall you tend to find that conservatives tend to be less interested in making it easy for people to vote through same-day voter registration or whatever. And they talk in the language of concerns about voter fraud, but I think there is a deeper history there of a feeling like you only really want the best people to be participating. And if people, if people are not, don't know much about politics and have that, maybe it's better to have them not participate. I think that there is still a strain that exists today in American conservatism, even though there's also a populist strain on the right that tries to rally all people to the conservative banner. And so, and it is true today that Americans who are wealthier overall are more likely to vote, to be politically conservative and to vote Republican. Although, interestingly, if you break Americans down by, not by income but by education, then you find that the most highly educated Americans tend to be more liberal. So there's a kind of a different axis that works for income than there is for education, even though, of course, income and education can often go hand in hand.
And thank you, John, for the call. We go to Peter next in Baraboo.
Thanks for taking the call. A great conversation. Anyone who understands anything about the arcs of history and politics knows that it tends to go from one fanatic extreme to the next. We have seen that here in Wisconsin. We certainly have experienced it over the last 25 to 30 years. Everything that was built in the Great Deal has, of course, been unwound. And I do believe that liberals, the left, quote, moderates are beginning to recognize that the pendulum has swung so far out of the norm that it is time to reconfigure. Bill Blasio in New York, what's going on with Colorado. There are many areas of which Wisconsin used to be one. My personal preference, as I have said many times, both on this radio and in my elected capacity, as a school board member and others, is that our citizenry needs to wake up. The forces of darkness tend to try to put people to sleep. George Lakoff has been very formative in helping people understand how language tends to define and divide and conquer people. So these terms have been used in ways that have no connection to their definition, liberalism, progressives, moderates, however you want to call it. But I do think the time is ripe, and I think your guest is exactly on target to help people awake to the idea that the great dream of what America stands for can be reclaimed.
Thank you, Peter. Thanks for the call. Peter.
Well, I think one of the interesting things that the caller said is that we've moved away from the norm. And I think a lot of these debates are really about what the norm is. So what people who consider themselves liberals or progressives tend to think is, well, look at what things were like in the 1950s in terms of economic policy. Even on some like, you know, a Republican like Dwight Eisenhower, taxes were much higher than they are today. You had stronger unions, you had more government protections, and that starting with Ronald Reagan, we really started to strip a lot of that away, and that produced this rising economic inequality and a much greater economic insecurity for working class Americans. For conservatives, I think, when they look at the baseline for what America should be like, they tend to go back much further. And they tend to, I think you find often amongst conservatives a kind of an idealized vision of what the 19th century was like. But when the federal government was very weak, when there wasn't much regulation of business at all, and what there was most likely to come from the states, and when anti-poverty was really the work often of local voluntary organizations. And I think they tend to think of that as a period of greater freedom. And although they think we never may get quite back to that point, I think they see that as the original America that has been polluted to some degree by this great larger government that they want to try to move in some ways towards. So it's a very different baseline of kind of what, in some ways, it's really a debate about whether you believe that the 20th century fundamentally and the series of expansions of federal power that took place, first with the progressives, then with the New Deal, then with Lyndon Johnson and the Great Society, whether those things ultimately made America a better society or a worse society. Mm-hmm. And I think in some ways that's part of that. That's kind of at the heart of this debate.
Thanks, Peter. A minute left. Mike, take it away.
Okay. Here's the way I feel. I consider myself a liberal because I'm an American. And all of us should succeed. But the reason is it bothers me if every American doesn't have health care. It bothers me if people can't work for decent wages. But it seems like conservatives, it doesn't bother them. And that's my problem. We're all in this together. And if it bothers me, if things aren't right, it should bother conservatives also.
Thanks, Mike, for the call.
Sure.
I think what a conservative would say is that it does bother them, but they believe that the best way for people to get ahead is to be free, is not for the government to try to do stuff for them that they think probably will be either ineffective or counterproductive and will hurt other people, but actually to kind of get out of the way and let them do it themselves. It's a very fundamentally different view of what it takes to get ahead in society. I think the conservative view tends to be much more about people doing it on their own, and the important thing is the government not standing in their way. I think liberals tend to think more that when people get ahead, it's really more of a joint collective enterprise, and that since government, we come together through government, that government is one of the key institutions that we use to basically give people the helping hand that they need to make it.
Peter, thanks so much. Great conversation, and we enjoyed having you. Thanks.
My pleasure.
Peter Beinert, contributing editor at The Atlantic and National Journal. The piece is Liberal is Good, published in the current Atlantic. You can see it on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Join us tomorrow, first hour, The Tenure Track. Hour number two, we celebrate Abe Lincoln's 205th birthday with the author of Lincoln's Boys, John Hay, John Nicolay, and the War for Lincoln's Image. Thanks to K.P. Whaley and Judith Sears-Poisson for producing this hour. Great conversations ahead.